Hello, my name is Phoebe Smith, and I want to tell you about my book, Wayfarer, Love, Loss and Life on Britain's Ancient Paths. Wayfarer tells the story of how I lost my way and found it again by walking the ancient pilgrim paths in Britain and elsewhere. Along my journey, I found hope, confronted past experiences, and learned more about myself than I ever thought I would. My book, Wayfarer, is out now and available in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.
On this month's Wonder Woman podcast,
she said that she encouraged all the ladies to do what they like to do and not to stop when the community said no.
I meet the first female scuba dive instructor in Jordan, who is one of only two in the predominantly Muslim country. I also experience silence and song on a classic train journey from Cape Town to Johannesburg in South Africa. And I catch 5 minutes with old school explorer Benedict Allen to find out what he thinks defines exploration in the modern era.
We mustn't think of explorers as in the past. We mustn't think of exploration as belonging to a certain specialist lot of people like me. It's about all of us.
I also offer my latest hard-earned travel hack, reveal the best train rides from around the world, and talk travel gear for a life on the road. Finally, I'll be revealing this episode's Wonder Woman of the Month, the traveller lost in the history books. You're listening to the Wonder Woman podcast, an audio travel magazine with me, Phoebe Smith, exploring off-the-beaten-track destinations, wild spaces, wildlife encounters, and the unsung heroes behind conservation efforts. Come wander with me. I had begun, as many journeys to the waterside fringes of South Africa do, at Cape Town. After a day spent wandering around the town itself, I wanted to get out and see more of the region before boarding the train. I wasn't keen on driving or taking a coach tour, but what were my other options? Turns out, a motorbike sidecar was the way to go. You're listening to the Wonder Woman podcast, where I'm in Cape Town, about to go on a sidecar tour. Is everyone ready?
Yay!
Oh, yes.
Let's go! We drove along the coast and through several communities where residents came out to wave as we trundled on by. Rather than being enclosed in the confines of a car, I felt I was still an observer, but one with benefits. I could take photographs, smell the aroma of food cooking from streetside grills, and drink in the scent of the brine of the ocean. At a viewpoint called Chapman's Point, we stopped to look at scenery, and I chatted to driver Sean about the route we were taking before jumping back on the sidecar.
We're standing overlooking from Chapman's Peak Drive. So this is one of the most spectacular roads sort of on the continent. You'll see when we go around the corner later what it looks like. Once we're through there, we go through Noordhoek, and then we're making our way to Baldus Beach, which is where the world-famous African penguins are located. It's the only penguin species on the African continent, and they housed in Baldus, which is in Simonstown. It's sort of our naval base, also used to be the old winter port for Cape Town, before all of that was reclaimed there in the city centre, or just outside the city centre. And then from there we head up along False Bay, so Kalk Bay, Muizenberg, some lovely little towns there, and we make our way across the Cape Flats area and then into Stellenbosch, one of the wine producing regions in the country.
It's very windy, but we're riding along the coast and we can just see the ocean stretching out, the Atlantic, and then one side is just masses of orange rock almost jumbled together like a puzzle rising to our left, and we're in a little convoy of four motorcycle and sidecars. Do you enjoy doing this part, Sean?
I love it, doesn't get old.
Yeah, I don't know how you could ever get bored of this. It's just stunning. Look at this beautiful white beach we're coming to ahead. Absolutely beautiful. Gabby, how are you enjoying it?
I'm having fun. Awesome.
And you're from South Africa. Have you done this before on a sidecar?
No, I haven't. This is my first time, so it's nice.
Would you do it again?
Definitely.
I want to get me one of these. We're taking this one when we go, Sean.
Of course, yes. Can I come with?
It had been an exhilarating introduction to South Africa's landscapes, but things were going to get even more thrilling when I met their wildlife. I must say, I feel a little bit like a kid on my way to see Santa. I cannot wait. I've seen penguins in Antarctica, and now I really am desperate to see these. I'm here with Claire. Claire, have you seen them before?
I have. We're very lucky, but it never gets tired.
So you're very excited as me.
Beside myself.
And we can hear the waves growing nearer, so any minute now, I'm hoping we'll stumble across them and capture my... Oh my God, I can see them! Catch my... Ah! They are so cute. There are so many of them! How many do we think there are? Oh my goodness! There's so many! There's one just standing in a little hole here, look! Just kind of sunning himself! Wow! As you can hear, it was hard to hide my joy at seeing the black and white flightless birds. So much so, I had to be torn away from them. But I did, after all, have a train to catch. The train did exactly what it said on the tin. It was comfortable, slow, and offered views of the mountains, winelands, and even a stop at Kimberley, home to the largest diamond mine in the country. Leaving there on the second night, I watched flamingos appear in a massive lake turned golden by the sunset. The next morning, almost drunk on good food and fine wine, we would reach Pretoria and take a taxi ride on to Johannesburg. But I still couldn't shake off the feeling of travelling through places evidently battling poverty while I was in such luxury. But a conversation with one of the staff members, William, made me see that having something like the Blue Train actually meant a lot to him, providing work so he could provide for his family. And how has working on the Blue Train, what does that mean to you? Is it...
Oh, it means the world to me. That means the world to me because I never knew the Blue Train before. Because as I started in 1999, we work under agent. Even now, we're still working under agent. So I remember the other day, it was December. Bianca, it was our boss, she called me. So, William, tomorrow we are going to Cape Town, go to Blue Train. So she gave me direction. So when I get there, I thought maybe it's a place we can just wait today and go home same day.
Yeah.
So then I went there, said now we are going to Cape Town. So it was my first time to see Cape Town live, not on TV.
Wow.
Actually, it was my dream to be in Cape Town one day, but so my dream came true. So it was hard because the way they do things is different, like on the other side. But the people were working here to be patient, they showed me how and this they do. No, the train is moving, you have to save. So, but I started in the bar. That's why I started learning until I get in the rooms and then the dining car. Now it's like a home to me.
20 years, it would be, yeah.
Once at Johannesburg, I wanted to see more of the real country, away from the five-star, and so I went to visit the newly gentrified township where art, fashion and startups have brought money and investment into this once no-go area. Its name is Maboneng. There, I met a street artist who, along with local guide Charles, put on an impromptu performance, freestyling.
Who wants to start words?
Anna.
Got me to freestyle about Anna. She's there wearing a blue top with the foam Samsung, and I got a lot of words to play around with. Anna looks like she's in Joburg, standing right next to the sculptures behind me. Rewind me, that's what you would be doing later
art.
When you're looking at art on your phone, because that's also artistic when it comes to playing around with art. That's exactly what I'm doing. But also, behind me is a lot of art, that sculpture, unless you want to see
South
the
Africa.
Street art, like in South Africa. There's a lot of street art as well, but South Africa is
nature.
A rainbow nation country because it's naturally a rainbow nation country. The people always congregated. But with nature comes the big five.
Home.
That means then you have to go for hope and pose. For hope, then you get some natural poses.
Freedom.
When it comes to freedom, that's exactly what South Africa is trying to strive for.
Following the music and art, my last stop was perhaps the most famous township of all, Soweto. There, much like how I'd started, avoiding coaching to get closer to where I was, I took a tuk-tuk designed by one pioneering local called Mfungo.
People first felt less human when tour buses would drive around the townships, having tourists inside a bus and while they are on the ground there. you know, it made them feel less of human beings.
Yeah, it was more so, like a safari.
Exactly, more like a safari drive.
Yeah.
Taking pictures from a bus.
Yeah.
And people felt like, no, this is not a zoo. Come down. And, you know, they go, wow, yes, this is the kind of tourism, you know, we've been longing for.
Yeah.
Where we can get to chat, where we can get to touch, where, you know, there's a lot of interaction happening. So that's one way, you know, that a lot of people of the township really appreciate.
And you said there's a word, isn't there, for the sense of community here?
Which is Ubuntu. Ubuntu, which simply means I am because you are, humanity. It's what keeps us going. Regardless of the color of the skin, regardless anything, there's only one race, which is human race.
A beautiful point made by Mfungo to end my journey. And I have to say, though there is no escaping a harrowing past, tourism and visitors are what have helped make South Africa a forward-looking nation, and one that, no matter how you experience it, by luxury train, sidecar or tuk-tuk, leaves a long and lasting impression. That was me reporting from South Africa on a recent week-long visit on assignment. And still, after that visit and a 10-day one before, I feel like I have still only just scratched the surface of the place. Now, I'm lucky that although the flight to Cape Town was long, around 14 hours in all, due to the mere 2-hour time difference with the UK, it means that jet lag was not something I had to worry about. But it's not always the way, which segues perfectly to my travel hack of the month, beating the dreaded jet lag. You know the feeling. Headaches, hungry at the wrong times, can't face eating at the right ones, waking up when you should be going to sleep. Jet lag can make the first few days of travel a nightmare, but there are a few steps you can take to minimise its effects. Step 1. Start to change your sleep routine a few days before you go, either going to bed later or waking up earlier, depending which direction you'll be travelling. That way you'll cut down the time it will take your body to adjust to the new time zone. Hack 2. Obey the new time zone as soon as you get on the flight. That means sleeping at the right time, working or watching TV at the right time, and sleeping or at least resting as if you're at your destination already. Number 3, drink water, and plenty of it. Dehydration makes the symptoms much worse. Hack 4, when you arrive, go with the time zone. If it's night, then go straight to bed. But if it's daytime, stay awake. Go outside to get natural light to help your body's circadian clock. Number 5, do some light exercise when you arrive. Yes, you won't feel like it, but a little walk or a swim can make all the difference. And finally, 6, don't worry. Stress will always make the symptoms worse. So try and keep calm and travel on. That was my travel hack of the month, the insight I offer every episode to make the journey as pleasant as the destination. And though that advice was for fighting jet lag, I have to say that as a diver, it sort of applies there too, especially the end bit, keeping calm. I actually returned a few weeks ago from doing my advanced diver qualification in the Red Sea, Jordan. On board, I met the crew, but one person in particular stood out. Her name was Wad. She's not very confident with speaking English, so had asked her manager Khalid to translate some of what she said. I'm here at Aqaba, and we've just spent a day diving on the Red Sea, and I have a very special lady with me called Wad, and she is special because she is one of only 2 ladies who is a dive instructor. So tell me, Wad, what got you into diving first? When was your first dive?
When? It's in 2013.
And what made you want to do it?
It's too happy. When I got in the water, I see everything, it's moving and silent. So that makes me very happy and very interested. That's why I'm going to diving.
And so you've been doing it now for, what, that's sort of 6 years that you've been teaching it to other people. What's your favourite thing about taking people out into the water?
Everything, actually. Yeah, everything. When they finished their diving, when they go up, they say, when I see the faces, it's heavy. That make me good.
And What sort of reaction was it when, because obviously you're the first woman in Jordan to do this, what was the general reaction?
شو بدي اجاوبها؟
ايه الاكشن اللي عشان انت اول بنت بتختصي، ايه الاكشن من الناس حواليكي بيشجعوكي؟
ايش بدي اجاوبها؟
They encourage you for, they go forward, they push you to be even more and more and more.
Yeah.
So there was no negative reaction
to it? Also,
sometimes there is a negative reaction because of the community, but in general, everyone is proud of her.
Yeah.
And then there's another lady who's got it, so one of two, and she, but you were the first.
Yeah.
Do you know her? Have you spoken to her?
Yeah.
And do you think it was because you had done this?
Actually, he did his first,
I understand.
She did her first dive with me. Then she decided to be instructor.
Okay, so she was inspired.
Yeah.
Inspired by you. Would you like to see more women dive instructors?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And why is it rare in Jordan for there to be female?
ليه هو قليل عدد السيدات اللي بتختص زيك؟
طيب احكي لها انه عشان انه احنا مجتمعنا ما بيخلي البنات دائما يكونوا يعملوا الاشياء اللي بدهم هي.
Because the community and one of the community area here, it's not allowed the girls to go outside for certain adventure excursion like this. So Wad is one of the bravest lady to go in and to just break these standards and go forward for.
And do you see, since you've done that, has there been a change? Is it slowly changing?
Yes, sure.
That it's more acceptable.
I make my friend, all my friends, they go into dive. When they saw me, I'm diving, they interested to be a diver.
And you dive with your headscarf on. Why is that?
Why? Because I'm with a scarf.
Yeah. So you just want to wear it. What is it, a special one or that you go underwater
with? That's normal. What
it's just there's not one made from the same material as a swimsuit or anything. It's just a normal.
It's make my dive, it's easiest.
Ah, I see. Well, and me and some of the other guests were saying how glamorous you look when you come out, because unlike us with our hair everywhere, yours just looks absolutely perfect. And who do you find a difference when you take people out, whether they're male or female, men or women? Is it different for you? Do you prefer one or the other? Or
في فرق بين أنت تاخدي البنات أو الأولاد من المية؟
No.
All the same.
Yeah.
All the same. And do you, you said, do you like being out there because it's silent and it's still, is it also the marine life, the fish that you enjoy to see?
Sure.
انت بتتكلمي عشان انت بتحب الغطس عشان السمك والمارين لايف والكلام
ده. Yeah.
And do you have a favorite dive site?
Yes. Which King Abdullah Reef. It's my favorite one.
Why?
Because I love it. It's my favorite because I see everything there. I see many fishes and I see the grass and the sand and the coral, everything.
And is there a certain level you want to get to? Do you want to keep moving up through the ranks, as it were, as a from a dive instructor to...
As a community education, dive instructor, master diver trainer.
And would you like to get to the point where you're perhaps teaching other Jordanian women to do what you do?
Sure, I did. Sure, I want to do it.
Yeah. And what would you say to anyone who says, oh no, you shouldn't be a dive instructor because you're a woman. What would you say to that?
اللي بتقولي للبنات ان هم بتشجعيهم ان هم يبقوا زيك دايف جايد ودايف انستراكتور.
طيب بدي احكي لك بالعربي وانت بدك تحكيلها بالانجليزي. انه انا بحب احكي لهم دائما انه انتوا اعملوا الاشياء اللي انتوا بتحبوها وانه ما تخلوا المجتمع انه يحصركم. دائما اعملوا الاشياء اللي انتوا بدكم اياها.
She said that she encouraged all the ladies to do what they like to do and not to stop when the community said no. Just they have to break the rules and go forward and do it what they like to do.
Wad is proof that breaking out of traditional roles can be very hard, but can inspire a great many more people to do the same. I do hope that next time I visit Jordan, there will be a whole host of female dive instructors, each encouraged by her example. Now, sticking with the slow and steady theme of the episode, from trains to scuba diving, is my top 10. And this month, it's got to be the best train journeys in the world. In at 10, the Night Riviera train, which leaves from London Paddington and journeys all the way to Penzance over a series of about 8 hours. It traverses rivers. It crosses by some of the most beautifully rugged coastline in the country And it's a very social train to hang out in the bar cabin too, I can attest to. In at 9, it's the Garn train, which journeys between Adelaide and Darwin on a north to south or south to north journey across Australia. It stops in places like the gorgeous, pun intended, Catherine Gorge. It stops at Alice Springs, where you have access to go and see Uluru in the Red Centre, and also a mining town called Cooba Pedy, where most residents live underground. In at 8 is the Orient Express. Made famous by the Agatha Christie novels, what's famous about it now is its sheer unbridled luxury as it crosses Europe. I've taken the journey between Venice and London, and there's something magical about going between the canal-veined city and our very own capital here in the UK. In at 7 is the Reunification Express in Vietnam. This is a railway line that goes across the country and was blasted to smithereens in the Vietnam War, but they managed to get it up and running again in just 2 years, showing how important it was to the people who lived there. In at 6 is a fairly new one. It is done by Belmont Trains, and it's the Cuzco to Machu Picchu Railway. What could be better than starting in a classically Peruvian town and journeying all the way to arguably the biggest icon in South America and perhaps the world? In at 5, it's Norway's Bergen to Oslo route, which traverses over the Hardangervidda, which is the ice cap where Scott and crew trained for their expedition to the South Pole. In at 4, it's the White Pass and Yukon Railroad that goes through Canada to Alaska. It's only a short trip, not an overnight one, but some of the passes you traverse, and if you think about how they actually put these tracks in place, it just simply blows your mind. Speaking of blowing your mind, next up at number 3 is Japan's Shinkansen, or bullet train, that goes from Tokyo to Kyoto. Going on this journey is spectacular. It's super fast, but it connects with it one of the most modern cities in the world, with perhaps one of the most traditional, Kyoto being the place, of course, where you can spy geishas walking around the old district. In at 2, one of my particular favourites, the Caledonian Sleeper. Go to sleep in London and wake up hours later with the sun shining, hopefully, in the Highlands of Scotland. And finally, the number one train trip in the world is the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Now, you can go from Vladivostok, you can go from various different routes, but the one that I did, the one that I think tops them all, is the one that starts in China. And I went through China, traversed through Mongolia, and then across Siberia to end in Moscow. It took just over 2 weeks, and it is still one of the most standout journeys I have ever done in my life. You can do it in luxury train, you can do it on the locals train. No matter how you do it, just go and take the train. Trains. An utterly classic way to travel and explore, and one that can be often pretty practical too. Something I discovered with the latest piece of travel gear from my supporters at Rohan. Surprisingly for me too, it was a travel skirt. Yes, gear fans, it's my wonderful gear section, presented in association with Rohan. And this time round, I was given a travel skirt to test. I know, right? Do I seem like the kind of person who would benefit from a skirt? Even a newfangled travel-specific one? Well, actually, yes, I was. This wasn't a teeny tiny fashion offering. This is a long, full-length skirt, which I happily admit to wearing as that for which it was intended, as well as a sleeveless dress. So double usage, really, depending on whether or not you want to keep it casual or dress it up. So what should you look for in a travel skirt? First off, consider the fabric. The one that this skirt was made out of was stretchy. That's how I could pull it up and make it into a dress. It was anti-crease. I'm a woman who does not believe in ironing. And quick dry as well, which is great because I like to get active no matter what I'm wearing. Look for comfort. The less seams it has, obviously, the better. And weight, you know, you want it to take up less room and grams in your luggage. The skirt I was testing was called the Serenity Long Skirt. It's made from a coolant technology, which is a treatment where microscopic particles of jade stone are heat set into the yarn. As a result, the fabric feels cool to the touch, which is very important when you're travelling in warm places like South Africa. And also, the jade stone helps to combat odour. So let's just put it down to it, anti-smell. There was also a pocket on the hip, which was disguised by the stripe pattern handily. and had an elasticated waist, which meant really good for comfort. So when did it come into its own, I hear you ask? When on earth would a Wonder Woman need a travel skirt? Well, the answers may surprise you. The first one, hiking. Believe it or not, it's actually easier to pee when you're wearing a skirt because you sort of have your own privacy curtain wherever you found yourself. I found myself in Wadi Rum Desert and, you know, I didn't look back after choosing to wear it. Diving. So you used to have to struggle under a towel, but instead, using a skirt and putting it up around my neck, I could get changed pre and post dive without having to wait to cramp myself into the ship's loo. And finally, I used it on the train because I could dress it up or dress it down, which in South Africa was very useful, especially when visiting more conservative places. Thanks very much to my friends at Rohan for supporting Wonder Woman on her travels. Do check out their website at rohan.co.uk. And remember, Wonder Woman listeners get a special discount when you go to the checkout and use the code WWN9. Happy shopping for your travel gear, everyone. Now, someone who always travels light, and particularly without much in the way of technology, is explorer and adventurer Benedict Allen, who famously got lost and then found again in Papua New Guinea a few years ago. I caught up with him after we judged the recent Stanford Travel Book Awards to find out what it means to be an explorer in more modern times. You're listening to the Wonder Woman podcast, and joining me now is an adventurer extraordinaire, I would say. Benedict Allen, hello.
Hello. Extraordinaire, yes. Lots of extraordinaire.
And so obviously you've had many adventures over the years. Do you have one that kind of was your defining adventure, would you say?
In a way, I suppose my defining one was my first trip to New Guinea, and I ended up going through a ceremony to make myself a man as strong as a crocodile. And it wasn't because I wanted to become a man as strong as a crocodile, it's just this is what the locals did. It was a sort of man-making ceremony. And for me, it was a way into another culture. I could never be Nyara. I could never be one of the locals because, you know, I was living in Shepherd's Bush and my culture, my background, my everything about me was alien. But I wanted to get a glimpse into this other world. And it was a very extreme thing, and I suppose I was very... Well, I was 24, and I was very idealistic, I suppose. I just thought, I'll do whatever it takes. And the locals said to me, look, this is what it takes us to understand our world. We learn in this initiation ceremony about how to cope in our world. And yes, there were secrets, there were stories handed down to this next generation of young men. But in my case, I just wanted a glimpse into this other world, just to get a feeling of what it's like to grow up in New Guinea. And that's what I did. I went through a ceremony that was a secret, sacred ritual. I was hidden away for as long as it took to become a man as strong as a crocodile, which turned out to be 6 weeks. And we were given permanent initiation marks, which were the markings of a crocodile, effectively hundreds and hundreds of little permanent scars up and down our chests and backs. And then we were beaten every day, four or five times a day. So it was a very thorough process, but in a way, it needed to be thorough for me personally to transform as much as I could into someone more of the local culture than someone from Shepherd's Bush. So it's a strange period for me, but it's actually a huge privilege, of course, because I was glimpsing and recording a ceremony that hadn't been recorded before.
And so you mentioned the scars. How did they do that? And are they still visible on your body today? How many years on?
Well, 35 years on, the years have gone by. And so this is a long time ago, 1984. Are they visible? I hesitate to show you. That's because we're alone in a stock room. I should say,
it's a glamorous location.
It's a glamorous location. We're surrounded by tinned drinks in sort of crates and old umbrellas.
Harry Potter mugs.
We're just alone out here. We don't know how to get out. But anyway, I shall rip off my clothing.
Oh, yeah, I can see some definite scarring.
I mean, it's all a long, long time ago. And they faded disappointingly, really, now. But there was a time when I went back to this community the following year, feeling I needed to build on this knowledge. These people had given me this extraordinary opportunity, and I felt that I owed it to them to go back, record more about their lives. And it got to the stage when I felt I couldn't keep going seesawing between my culture and their culture. I felt I'd never be one of them, of course not. But I also was beginning to feel I was never settling here in Britain, and I felt I really needed to steady myself and launch out from my homeland, which is essentially Europe, Britain and Europe. And so I stopped going there deliberately and used Britain as my base, and off I would go on my different adventures, my explorations. But to me, same principle always applied. You'd go to the local people and learn as much as you can about how they see the world.
And what would you say to people who aren't going for quite an extreme sort of reason as you did, and to try and become as strong as a crocodile, but actually do still want that immersive experience and to in some way engage with the local people, but say on a 2-week holiday? What sort of advice could you sort of give them?
This definitely wasn't a holiday. And I think it was about commitment, really, and a commitment of time, perhaps, above all. I'd say if you're on a holiday, it's very different rules apply. Because you're just going to get a snapshot, really. And you can't expect too much of any depth in a couple of weeks. But I would say try and go back to the same place, but try and go with a spirit of openness. I think when I was a little boy, I wanted to be an explorer in the mould of Shackleton, Speke, Stanley, Burton, you know, the great explorer figures. But actually they went in with quite a hard approach. They were very sure of themselves and their culture. And they're going out to record the world, but it's on their own terms. And actually, I began to see there's a value in being vulnerable. And you shouldn't be ashamed of that. It's great to open yourself up, be vulnerable. And I think you can go with that spirit, whether you're on a holiday or a trek for a few weeks or for 6-9 months, as I used to do it.
And you mentioned about going back to places, and obviously you went back to Papua New Guinea fairly recently in the last couple of years. How was that? Because there is that old adage that you should never go back, you know, let it stay as this wonderful memory. What would you say to that?
I was expecting it to be a disaster in a sense. I thought the world would have changed and that the forest that I used to know and that I, in a sense, grew up with, because I knew so many people so well, having gone through hell effectively for 6 weeks, being beaten 4 or 5 times a day. So I knew a lot of people very, very well. And I thought their world would have changed and this cult of the crocodile would be sort of irrelevant to them. But to my amazement, the world hadn't changed. The village looked exactly the same. And I suppose even if the village had changed, the fact of the matter was I had a commitment to those local people. And going back, seeing these people who I'd shared an experience with was a wonderful thing. The planet will change. That's the nature of life, and it's the nature of growing up. And now I went back as a maturer person, able to judge much better the context, the lives of the local people, and judge myself better. And it was absolutely wonderful. And I'd also tried to have that same sense of allowing myself to be vulnerable, because if you're vulnerable, you're open. And if you're open, you're open to whatever is there. So I was relieved the forest was there. I think it was good in my case to go back, because I just thought, wow, I was so fortunate all that time ago to have had that experience, and now I can build on that experience. So even if the place had been changed radically, it still, the people would have been there, and I valued those friendships. And friendship is all about not just a moment in time, but a relationship. So I could build on that relationship all these years on.
Were they still doing the crocodile and beating ceremony?
they were. Times had changed. It wasn't as intense as before. I haven't seen it again. It's said to be the two villages of this Nyara group of people are only doing the ceremony now. So it has been reduced. I think they fitted around school holidays, which I was thinking, why would you want to have a holiday being beaten every day? So it's been shortened. But in the end, there's still this belief in themselves. They know this is something they do that no one else in the world does. And that gives them a sense of who they are, a sense of pride, a sense of belonging to a place. And so that much is still very much valued. Because people think of the days of exploration as in the past. And it's so important, it seems to me, that we recognise we all are explorers by our very nature. It's what makes us human. We're all curious about the world. So we mustn't think of explorers as in the past. We mustn't think of exploration as belonging to a certain specialist lot of people like me. It's about all of us.
Me and Ben could have talked for hours about what it means to be an explorer in this day and age, but I wanted to just quickly ask him what he made of the media furore about him getting lost because he'd gone into the jungle with no way of contacting the outside world.
I suppose people automatically assumed that I was a throwback to another era. I was sort of someone who thought he was David Livingstone, who still wanted to explore in that old school way. I'd say the opposite, which is that it's never been more valuable to disconnect. And of course a GPS is an amazing gadget, and of course a phone is an amazing thing. You can communicate to schools and so on while you're having that experience. But for me, it's about cutting myself off, because we are so connected. And I think it's important that some people step away, disconnect, and it's never been more the case that we're, you know, I've got a phone in my pocket and the message is coming in now. But there's a time and place for that, I think, and it's very valuable that certain of us leave as much as we can aside and embrace the place instead of keeping in contact with the world that we're already familiar with.
And one final question then, with that in mind, what is your absolute cannot leave home without piece of kit?
Oh no, I always find it hard to think that. Do you know what? It's not a piece of kit. It's just photos of my children. It sounds pretty sentimental, but I have to remember I'm a different bloke than I was at the beginning. As a young man, off I went. And yeah, it could have been a young woman. It wouldn't have made any difference. But I had a commitment only to my expedition. I saw it in those days. And I suppose I owed it to my mum and dad to get back. But for me, I just have to keep reminding myself, this is what it's all about. Just take things back one step and not risk too much. But in terms of kit, I usually have a survival kit. What's my most important thing? I've honed it right down, and there is no single item that's more valuable than the rest. My favourite is perhaps a straw, and it's a simple straw, and I love it for the fact that it's so light, it seems so inconsequential, but actually to be able to drink from a leaf, to drink from a puddle, with that straw, it can save your life, because if you try and suck water from a muddy puddle, that puddle will become unusable after a while. It will get messed up. But with the straw, you can just take a bit of water here, take a bit of water there from where it's been trapped in the vegetation or whatever. So I love the neatness of that. And there's the usual thing, compass, fishing hooks, fishing lines and that sort of thing. But I love the straw because it's got that extra little thing that can help you on your way.
Wow, love it. Straw and embrace the place, I think, is what I'm taking away from that. Benedict Allen, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you, Phoebe.
That was Benedict Allen and me chatting in a store cupboard. Thanks very much to Stamfords for giving us a quiet space to catch up in. Well, we're nearly at the end of the episode. All that's left is for me to reveal who the Wonder Woman of the Month is. I hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. If you have, please do subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And do consider leaving a review. It really does help. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Phoebe R. Smith. Go to my website, phoebe-smith.com, and sign up for all my news via my newsletter. And of course, do check out my friends at rohan.co.uk, where you can enter the code I gave earlier at the checkout to get a discount off your order. Now, without further ado, here's the traveller who should be a household name, but few have heard of. Introducing my Wonder Woman of the Month. In the midst of World War I, a young woman was in university studying history when she decided it was the future rather than the past that she needed to focus on. She left and headed to Italy to serve as a nurse to wounded soldiers. During that time, she got engaged, but it was a short-lived affair, and a few years later, her father gave her a place in Italy. Despite living there with all she needed, when the war ended, she kept going back to London to learn Arabic, becoming increasingly captivated by the Middle East. In 1927, she finally headed to Lebanon and made it her mission to travel to Damascus, meeting and working with locals on her own. By this time, she was in her mid-30s and single, and her very presence there, in an area governed by martial law, could have ended in her murder. Happily, it didn't, and having learned more advanced Arabic, our heroine went back to London to take a drawing class so she could sketch her own maps next time she went there. By 1929, she was headed, this time, to Baghdad. While there, she socialised with the British military, but also locals, and decided to hire a Bedouin guide to take her into the desert, something colonial law forbade, and which, like the other time, she ignored. Spurred on, she learned Persian, and in 1930 went on a mission to seek out the Valley of the Assassins, which at that point had not been explored by any other European. She travelled by horseback, with a local guide, and despite contracting malaria, dysentery, and dengue fever, she returned to the UK with the map she'd made. Suddenly, this woman, Freya Stark, was finally taken seriously. She continued to travel and produce maps for Kurdistan, Yemen, Egypt, and Iraq, to name just a few. So valuable was her knowledge and ability to interact with locals that she was recruited as an advisor to the British colonial administration during World War II to help influence locals to being pro-British. She learned Turkish at 60 to travel to Asia Minor and wrote a plethora of books. Despite illness and frailty, she refused to stop travelling, visiting Afghanistan in her 70s and Annapurna in the Himalaya in her 80s. Tough and resilient, she gained trust in closed societies through befriending women in harems, which gave her unparalleled access to the powerful men who ran things. She was always told she wasn't a beauty and was chastised by many for not living like a quote-unquote normal woman by getting married and settling down. She was still unapologetically womanly, though, saying, "There are few sorrows through which a new dress or hat will not send a little gleam of hope, however fugitive." And despite all this, it's T.E. Lawrence that has become the household name when it comes to Arabian exploration. Let's try to change that, shall we? Freya Stark is my, and all of yours, Wonder Woman of the Month. In the next episode of the Wonder Woman podcast, join me as I go bog hiking in Estonia. I also speak to the man working hard to convince us all that manta rays, all too often poached for Chinese medicine, are worth far more alive than they are dead. I catch up with author and fellow wild sleeper Robert McFarlane, offer my pick of the best long-distance walks in the world, and explain how you can pack like a pro, plus much, much more. See you then. Wonder Woman out. The Wonder Woman podcast is written and edited by me, Phoebe Smith. The producer for this episode is Daniel Nielsen. The wonderful logo was designed by John Summerton, and the photograph is by Claire Rodley. Thanks to our partner, Rohan, and a final thanks to all the people I met on my journey and were willing to talk to me. It's because of you that this podcast is able to happen at all. Hello, my name is Phoebe Smith. And I want to tell you about my book, Wayfarer, Love, Loss and Life on Britain's Ancient Paths. Wayfarer tells the story of how I lost my way and found it again by walking the ancient pilgrim paths in Britain and elsewhere. Along my journey, I found hope, confronted past experiences and learned more about myself than I ever thought I would. My book, Wayfarer, is out now and available in hardback, ebook and audiobook.